next guest on the Offside Rule Exclusives is England women's record goal scorer Kelly Smith. The former Arsenal striker retired from football in January 2017. She was part of the quadruple-winning Arsenal ladies team of 2006-07, scoring 30 goals in 34 games across the four competitions and voted Players' Player of the Year 2 years in a row. Widely regarded as England women's best ever player, injuries plagued her career, but Smith still managed to represent the national team at 3 European Championships and 2 World Cups. A trailblazer in the women's game, Smith was appointed as a player coach at Arsenal in 2013, but is currently taking time away from football to raise her first child.
The Offside Rule Exclusives with Kate Borsay and Lindsay Hooper.
Well, Kelly's kindly invited Kate and I into her home. Two dogs are locked away. There's a baby upstairs sleeping. Our first impression, Kate, is one of a busy household, wouldn't you say?
That's right, Rocco sleeping, well, kind of sleeping upstairs, which is quite an achievement at this time of night for a 10-month-old. Tell us about being a mum, because that's been a huge change.
Oh, my God, yeah. I think, you know, it's really changed my lifestyle, my mentality of life, really, because I've put so much emphasis on my football career over 20 years, and having Rocco has just really made me so happy. And not to neglect anything that I've done in my football career, but he's the best trophy that I've ever won, if I can say that. But no, if you know what I'm saying, it's just he is the ultimate now, and that is my main focus, all about Rocco.
Have you purposely taken a bit of a break away from football? Are you still digesting it? Are you still following it as much? Or has it been nice to sort of have a bit of a hiatus?
Yeah, I've obviously been on maternity leave now for 10 months, which has been fantastic, really raising him and really bonding with him. So it's been a pleasure to do that. But I've been trying to keep up with football as much as possible, but it's very, very difficult because I don't really have a lot of time on my hands to watch games. I try and do it as much as possible when he's in bed, just to keep up to date with stuff because of, you know, the few media bits of work that I've been doing. I need to know my knowledge and what's going on in the football world.
Do you think about how football will fit in with Rocco's life?
Well, to be fair, he loves football already. He's just about walking. Obviously, I have to stand behind him, but he knows what a football is. I say to him, where's the football? And he goes and kicks it, and we play football in the kitchen and in here. And he's in his mind to kick it. It's really weird. I spoke to her. We have a nanny a few days a week, and she said, I've never seen a baby that young kick a ball. So she said it's because of me. So it really is surprising.
So this is exciting.
Well, yeah, I might go and put a bet on that he could play for Arsenal or England. But no, it's, you know, I would love him to play football. But if he doesn't, if he's not sporty, that's fine too. I just want him to be happy, healthy and do what he wants to do.
Kelly, a lot of these podcasts, we started out with early life and how things started out and where people found their love for football. And I'm going to mix it up a little bit with you because I think we should go backwards a little bit. I want to start with what football means to you, what it has actually done for you in your life and how you think of it.
Football was my world, was everything to me. From a very young age, from the age of 6, I always had a football at my feet. If it wasn't a football, it was a stone, kicking a stone to school. If it was, my mum had told me off for smashing a vase in the front room, knocking with the ball, it would be a balloon or socks rolled up. So it always had a sphere at my feet, just working on my technique and my touch. And I grew up loving the game. I watched Match of the Day, I would tape it, and I would practice the turns and the moves and imagine myself on the pitch. And from a young age, it was always something that I was really passionate about and kind of good at, if not being too big-headed. But I just love playing football with the boys in the playground, jumpers down for goalposts. And obviously it progressed from there because of the love for it. I then joined a boys' team where I got kicked off for being a girl, and then joined another boys' team and the same thing happened. And then I had to go and find a girls' team to play on.
Is it right that the parents petitioned against you playing because they were embarrassed?
Yeah, they didn't want to field a side against our team because of pure fact that I was a girl and I was good and I was making their sons embarrassed. I would dribble around them and score, you know, 5-6 goals a game. And they just couldn't handle it. So they said, we're not fielding a team. So it wasn't fair on my team that I still played that because we would never get a game. So that's part of the reason why I had to finish playing and find a girls' team a couple of towns over.
So is something like feminism, is that something that you were quite starkly aware of quite early on, that things weren't the same for women?
Yeah, definitely. You know, a love and a passion that I had for the game, and being told that I couldn't do it, it was soul destroying for me, because I really, that's what I was good at. That's what I wanted to do. All my friends were boys. So to be told that I couldn't do that, it really was upsetting. And but it made me even more determined to prove people wrong that, you know, I can play football. Just because I'm a girl, it doesn't matter.
When you were watching Match of the Day, whose turn was it that you were emulating?
I was literally about to ask the same thing.
It was mainly Ryan Giggs, because I was the same player as him. I liked to dribble with the ball at my feet. I was left-footed, he was left-footed. He was a left-winger, I was a left-winger. So I kind of role-modelled myself, idolised him, and just watched him in the games and tried to do certain things in certain parts of the field that he would do, and take that into my game on the football pitch.
You found a girls' team, but ultimately your route to becoming England's first professional female football player sort of started in America, really. Did it have to start in America? Was there any other option for you as you saw it at that time?
Yeah, that was the only option, because I've said that women's football at that time was a bit of a joke, because we were training two nights a week. And, it, you know, I was getting home at 11, half 11 at night, because we could only use the ball court at 8 o'clock at night, when most of the men and the youth have used the facilities. So it wasn't taken serious at all. And in America, you know, the scholarships and the universities out there, but they were training every day with a ball at their feet and obviously studying and trying to get their education. But for me, that was the ultimate, to try and get a scholarship and train every day, because that's, I knew I'd improve, and I wanted to improve and, you know, try and be the best that I could be.
You've been called one of the most naturally talented female players of our time. There's an incredible amount of respect for you, and I think some of our listeners here who don't know a lot about you may not know the scale of your skill and your talent. I mean, it's absolutely huge. And actually, and actually still in today's modern game as well, because of course you can be very good 20 years ago and it not those skills not translate to the modern day. But actually, if you were still playing, you'd still be cutting it with the best. When did you realise you had something a bit different, something a bit special? Was it quite late on, or was it early?
No, it was during the boys' games, because I was probably the best player on the pitch and scoring so many goals per game, and I just felt I was just really natural with the ball at my feet. It was easy for me to go around players and slot the ball into the back of the net, or to see an assist and put somebody in. I realised that I was different from everybody else at around about 6 or 7.
And when that scope, when that pond got bigger for you as the fish, when you went to America, was there any doubt? Was there any concern? Or was that, you know, again, somewhere where you felt naturally very happy, very at ease, very, very capable to match their level?
There was a lot of concern, because I was only 17 years old, and leaving my parents, my friends, my family was a massive feat for me to do, because I'm quite a homebody and I was quite shy and reserved and not that confident. So for me to take myself to a country where I didn't know anyone was very, very frightening. I was crying as I was boarding the plane, but I knew I had to do it to pursue my dream of being a professional athlete. And, you know, I had a horrendous time out there for the first 3 or 4 months. I was so homesick. I regretted the decision daily. I was constantly crying on the phone to my parents saying, I want to come back. And we scheduled a phone call every Sunday just to talk about how I was feeling. And it got easier, and my mum, you know, eventually said, you know, make it 2 weeks and then we'll check in. And then it turned out that I was what they were calling me to make sure that I was all right, because I actually, you know, I really settled in quickly, but after 5 or 6 months, I kind of liked it and really started enjoying it.
Kelly Smith, the Offside Rule exclusives.
The sacrifices that you had to make, not only the upheaval of going to another country to pursue this, but, you know, football was the end goal. But along the way, it did mean that you ended up having to really rely on your dad on certain occasions. And I remember you've told me before that your dad had to fly out, didn't he, to come and basically rescue you at one point in your life. And does that make you have a different relationship with football? I mean, although the end goal was great and you had an amazing career, there were these other offshoots from this love for football, which actually were quite damaging.
Yeah, I hated football when I was in my worst state. You know, I didn't want to play anymore. I was in a really bad spiral of drinking every day, upset, couldn't move because I was on crutches, in had a plaster cast on. I had three serious injuries back to back, and you know, I thought about committing suicide because I didn't know which way to turn. I didn't have football. I didn't have my family close to me. And as I said, I wasn't really buddy-buddy with anybody out there. They were my colleagues. They were my teammates, but they weren't really my friends. They didn't really know me inside out. So I hid a lot of my drinking and, you know, pretended that I was okay, and I really wasn't okay. And that's when my dad flew out to kind of rescue me.
And with women's football at that time, there wasn't the sort of professional backup either, was there? Like the PFA or the people that you could speak to about these problems?
There was nothing. And I had no guidance, no support. And that's part of the problem as to why I got myself so low and so sad, because I didn't lean on anybody and I didn't speak about my feelings. And since obviously going through rehab and getting older, and really knowing myself and coming to terms with who I am as a person, you know, that I suffered a few injuries later on in my career, and I didn't go down that route because I'd had that experience of pulling myself through and speaking to people, and you know, going through therapy really helped.
We know about the drinking. You've written about it before, and that doesn't take any of the shine off it at all, that vodka was really seeing you through. And I've read that you would, you know, drink until you pass out, basically. Just picking up on the suicide side of it, that's really low, Kelly. I mean, that's really, really horrible to hear, actually. What do you feel when you think about that time? And drinking's one thing, but, you know, suicide's another. How did you get from one to the other? How did those feelings get so bad that you felt there was no other alternative than to not be here?
Well, when I was so out of it, you know, you're not thinking rational. You're by yourself. I was by myself in my apartment and absolutely smashed and not thinking. And, you know, I'd go to the cupboard and I'd hold a bottle of paracetamol and shake them and just see how many are in there, and think about just necking them with my drink, because I didn't want to be, I didn't want to live anymore. And that was, you know, really, really difficult for me to go through. I'd look around my apartment and see what's the best fitting where I could hang myself, because I didn't have football. I couldn't express myself, and I was, as I said, I was quite a reserved, shy person, so I really expressed myself on the football pitch, and that's where I love to be. And that I couldn't do that for a number of years, and I just didn't know which way to turn.
Did you tell your dad about those feelings? Is that why he came out, or did that not come till later?
The suicidal thoughts I didn't tell him about, but he could just tell. He's my dad. He knew that I was in a bad way, and I just said, look, I've had enough. And he said, right, I'm going on a plane the next day. And he come out, he helped me sell my car, we got my dog all the right papers from the vet to fly her back, and then sold all my furniture and stuff like that, and then I was straight back home.
So if your dad wasn't there, if he didn't pick up on that, that doesn't bear thinking about, does it? Especially because you're in such a different place now. You know, we're kind of fast forwarding on what, sort of 15 years or so?
Yep.
And you're in such a different place now. But it makes me so sad that today might not have been because you were in that state.
Yeah, and certainly he's my saviour. I've told him that many a times, for him to come out there and do that for me, which he says it's his job, it's his, that he's my dad and he knew me, and that's what dads do. So he did what was the best thing for me at the time, and I'm his little girl and always will be, and we've still got a really close relationship now. But yeah, those times are really dark and horrendous, but that's in my past now, and I don't really think about that too much. It's, you know, my life has changed so much. I have finished my career on a high, and then obviously fell pregnant as soon as I finished. So I'm in a happily happy relationship and loving life at the minute.
What it does go to show is that the achievements that you made, it makes them even greater, because how many people would have got to where you did having to go through all those hurdles? A lot of people, I'm sure, even at a similar time to you, were falling by the wayside. They would have said, nah, that's too tough. You know what, I'm not going to carry on doing that. They might not have been having exactly the same experience, but in terms of footballing terms, the one thing you can say is that the experience with the boys' teams, there would have been people your age going through something similar and saying, you know what, I'm not going to go down this football route because I can't. It's not possible. You know, just giving in. So why was it that you kept going and seeing it through and then and managed to actually become one of the most famous names in the game?
Yeah, I think I've got a real sense of pride, and I knew I wanted to win so many trophies and be recognised as one of the best players in the world, and I couldn't just walk away from the game. I wanted to at times, but I just, so there's something in me that didn't want to give up, and each injury that I had, I just got my teeth gritted and just thought, get your head down and work as hard as you can in your rehab and get back and prove people wrong, because people write you off. Mm. You know, after the third or fourth injury, she's not going to come back. She's not going to be the same player. And I think that was an extra motivation for me, because I knew I had the technique and the talent. If I just applied myself, and if I could get a good year or two without injuries, I knew I could really help Arsenal and England reach, you know, high targets.
What makes this even more interesting now, when you've got the comparison of since we talk about the Olympics and potentially 2015 World Cup being a changing point in women's football, which was the Olympics, the very, very end of your career, and the 2015 World Cup, you were actually part of the Fox Sports team, punditry. Mm-hmm. So up to that point, your name is one of the biggest names in women's football, to the point where, as someone who's been involved in football a lot myself and spoken to a lot of people, you'd say to anyone, name me an England women footballer, and they say Kelly Smith. And you're the role model. You're it. That's the role model. And now you do it now. And you'll have Lucy Bronze, Steph Horton, Fran Kirby, Jodie Taylor after recent events. And there are a few names that people say, but yours was it. That was the name that everyone said. And how different is that for you?
It's weird. I don't really view it like that. I think, you know, I had my own career path and I had to choose my path because the women's game wasn't where it is now. So I had to leave to go to America. I had to play in two professional leagues out there. And the game was booming out there. So I loved my time out there. And after 99, when the US women won the World Cup, the attendances that we were getting at the games were thousands. And to play in America and against the best players in the world at that time was phenomenal. And I really, you know, my mindset out there was just a full professional. And I learned how to train like an American, because they're all focus driven, they give everything every training session, and it's not like how it was back in England, where it was, you know, some people didn't even turn up for training, but they'd still play in the game on Sunday. Whereas in America, you were focused, you were driven, you give everything in training, you come off sweating, and you know, it was all camaraderie and teamwork. Whereas in England, it was very, very different at that time.
What was it like coming back to England? Was it like, oh, there's our Flash Kelly plays over in the States, you know, look at her with all the skill and the precision passing? Or did you just fit right back in? Because at that time, really, you know, honestly, there was a gulf between what was happening in America and what was happening in England. And that was in no small part due to the fact that the structure in England didn't support what was happening in America. And perhaps now we are seeing more of what England women are capable of because of all that structure in place by the FA.
And other players followed you, didn't they? I mean, you'd gone out to America and then we saw other players going out and following what you'd done.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I just think that it was, I had to do it just for me personally, because the game was nowhere near where it needed to be. But now I look at the way the structure of the game is in England now, and how much money is involved in the game, and the fans, the attendance is a lot bigger. I tell the youngsters now that they don't need to go to America, because you have it all on your doorstep. If you want to be a professional athlete now, you can be it in England and you can earn a career out of it. So there is no need to go to America. A lot of the best players aren't in America anymore. They're in England. Mm. A lot of the top European players are here.
A lot of the Americans are coming over to give it a go as well, aren't they?
A lot of nationalities are here all across the world, because they see now the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool, all pumping a lot of money into their program. And the way the game's developing, it's obviously the national team is doing really, really well. And England now is a leading force in world football.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, The Offside Rule TV, for exclusive video football content.
As Lindsay said, you were the poster in the bedroom of the girl who played football, the only one, for a long while.
There was Kelly, and there was also that. Oh, and she's with the captain, but they didn't know. And it was like, yeah, it's Faye White.
Yes,
Faye,
yeah.
And I, Faye and I used to, people used to think I was Faye and people used to think she was Kelly. Great. So we used to banter about that a little bit. But just because we're blonde, that's all.
And women.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
similar.
Now, there are several household names in the England women football team. But here's my concern that the game's accelerating, it's growing, and that's great. But so is the pressure and the profile of some of these players. Is there a danger that some may get too big for their boots? And let's be really frank about this. Have you seen anything like that? Have you seen instances of that?
You know, the way the game's going, there's a lot more money involved. Had a boot sponsor, and only not many people had boot sponsors back then. Now everybody has a boot sponsor. Everybody's on, somewhat decent money for their clubs and an England Central contract that have gone up over the years. And there's a lot more money involved. I just hope the women in the game don't, you know, look at themselves as being arrogant because it's not the right place to be. I don't think that's the way the women's game is and has been.
Is there a word of warning for you here? Because you must have seen. I mean, it's partly human nature. Whether you're a footballer, whether you happen to be doing well in business, whether you feature in a TV program, whether you are someone plucked off the street and suddenly become a reality TV star, right? It basically happens. It's part of human nature. So, what's the warning from you?
Just keep your feet on the ground because the women's game isn't like that. And I don't want it to go that way because for so many years, you know, even before my time, there were women that had less than what we had in my era. And now you see the players have got a lot more and some of them can be a little bit big-headed.
What have you seen that you don't like?
Just the comments that I've heard about, you know, certain players wanting this money or wanting to be the face of this team, little things.
Is there agent issues as well, do you think?
Massively, yeah. The way I think even some of my academy players are asking me about agents and they've not even made it in the game yet. They're 18, 19 and they're looking for an agent. I mean, it's just crazy. I don't think that they should be thinking about that. They should be getting their head down, trying to make the Arsenal first team and then see what happens after that. If you play well on the pitch, then your agent will come to you. You shouldn't be looking for an agent at, you know, when you're not even playing first team football yet.
See, this is why you have great value as a coach, because not only because of what you could offer in coaching capacity, but because of your experience and the dressing room talk that you could give. But it seems like that's something you might be putting on hold for a while, especially seeing as your new mum. But did you enjoy that? Did you enjoy that part of it?
Yeah, it was difficult for me because, you know, finishing my career and then going straight into the coaching role of the development team, it's so different when you're playing because you just think about yourself and you go out and you play and you perform and you have a laugh with your teammates. Whereas when you're the step on the other side of the coaching sideline, you know, you're the one person that everybody's looking at now. You have to set up all the sessions. You have to really plan the sessions with your assistant coach. You have to meet before the sessions, talk about it. What's your outcome? And then you have to affect every player within the session. You have to, you know, debrief the session, go away, talk about who played well. So it's so much prep and planning. And then obviously the games, setting up all the kit.
See, that's so different because the way that I view you as a player was it's instinctive. You know, you've already spoken about how it was natural. You were playing with these boys, it was an instinctive thing. And then you've got to put that into words and you've got to say, okay, well, go around this cone and do this. And that's how you do what I did. It must be so difficult.
It was very hard for the first couple of months. I really was so nervous every session because it just felt like it was very unnatural for me to be telling people what to do and just trying to show them certain pictures on the field as to what they should be doing and what was probably a better option that they could have made. It was very difficult. And just to have the conversations with them about their performance after the game and their end of season meetings, being honest was with the players. Yeah, it's very difficult.
Do you then necessarily think that being a great footballer, you can be a great coach?
No, it doesn't work like that at all. I think you can see that Wenger wasn't a very good player. Mourinho wasn't a good player, but they've both been fantastic managers. It doesn't mean that just because you've been reached the highs of being regarded as one of the best in the world, that you're going to be a good coach. And, you know, that's, but people expect me to be a good coach because I'm a good player. And there's an added pressure there from the outside that I know everything. I don't know everything. You know, I'm still at the bottom of the coaching ladder on the coaching pathway. And that I had to kind of take with a pinch of salt and just not care what people think. And think that I know everything, because I really, really don't.
So after the Mark Sampson affair, and then you, there was all the speculation about who would take the England job, and there were many people from different quarters who were so opinionated when Phil Neville did get the job that it should have been someone with more experience in the women's game. I mean, where were you on that fence?
Well, when my name was touted, I actually laughed at it, because there's no way I'm ready to take on the England women football job. No way. I know all the players and I know them quite well, but for me to step into that role was never, ever going to happen. I did come out and say I thought it should have been a female coach, because I think females don't work in the men's game. All the doors are closed. So if you're good enough and you have the right qualifications, you know, you should be put, if you want the job, you should, you know, be a contender for it. Mm. Phil Neville didn't go for the job, and he was given the job. So you can see why people are irate about it. But on hindsight, I think, you know, it was out of the blue. It was a shock one. And I think he'll do really well, because I know that the players really respect him because of his career. He's played under Sir Alex Ferguson. He's got all that coaching, obviously, that experience there. He's won trophies for Manchester United, Champions League. He actually was a coach before taking this job. He has his pro licence, but he just hasn't had his own team. Mm-hmm. And I know, speaking to some of the players, they're really up for it, because he's really down to earth and he wants to win. He's coming from a winning background, and that's what all these players want. They want to win a major tournament.
Reaction when he first got the job? Come on. Be honest. What? Because we were pretty shocked. Mm. I think most football fans were pretty shocked, because it did appear to come out of left field for me anyway.
It's like Kelly said, he was approached for it, wasn't he? So that's why it was a bit of a shock.
Well, I think the way the Mark Sampson affair was handled, I was told by a good source that they had three really good candidates that had got through to the final interviews. But then when they were told that their history would be dug up, that all three of them fell away at the last moment. So they had all the three contenders that were good for it just pulled away. So then they had
were they none. Male or female? Do we know?
A couple were two were female, one was male. So yeah, it just says it all that everyone's got skeletons in their closet. Mm. But I think the way it was just handled, one of them had kids, so the guy didn't want his kids to be ridiculed or anything about his past. So it went like bang, bang, bang. Three top contenders fell away, and they were back to no one. So I think that's probably why.
And even then with Phil Neville, it didn't stop them going through his tweets. Well, it didn't. Oh, yeah. It didn't kind of pay off all that due diligence, because what might have put off one worthy, able manager for that job, what might have put the FA off for that person, didn't put them off for Phil Neville in the end, because tweets were revealed where he appeared to be making quite sexist comments towards women and towards his wife.
I think a lot of people, though, knew that the context of those, it's a difficult one, because I see, you know, when they were written and you read them out loud, they appeared very bad. But as someone who knows Phil, I've only met him a few times, I've worked with him a few times, but he has got that sort of tongue to him where you know that it's not really meant. It's like said a bit in jest.
But it didn't excuse the first few encounters that the public and the press had with him being a bit calamitous, really. He didn't appear to know a lot of his players or know, you know, their particular strengths or history. Now, you know, who am I sitting here saying, well, of course he's been offered this job. Should he know every single thing about every single player? But I'll return to those three candidates. I bet they probably knew a lot more than Phil Neville did.
Yeah, they were all involved in the women's game across international level and club level. So, yeah, they knew everything. They knew every player. They knew the system. Yeah, it was It's just the way it is. So I think when I first heard it, I was like, wow, okay. I know there's going to be a lot of negative press, but why not give him the back in? And when I saw his press conference up at St George's Park, the amount of press that were there for an England women's manager was unreal. So I think it's just the initial few months, and let's see how he does. You know, what will happen if he does win the World Cup? You know, this is a possibility. Yeah. England ranked second in the world. They're going to qualify top of their group. I think they've got a really, really good chance. USA aren't the team that they used to be. Germany aren't the team they used to be. Sweden aren't. And England are on the up. I really think, you know, if they had that little bit of luck with, that you do in tournaments, and the team get on and he gets rid of some of the bad eggs, then I think they've got every opportunity to win it. I think it's great that the way the game is going now, because there's so much more profile. You see the young girls that are there really cheering on the players, and it's the grassroots level that you really want to hit, get the girls interested. Even if they don't want to play football, there's other careers that they can have in football: refereeing, coaching, journalism, all across the board. The
Offside Rule exclusives are available to download for free via Audioboom and iTunes.
Just looking at the harmony and all of those things that have happened in the game in the last couple of years, do you think that's perhaps the biggest challenge right now, is to get that right?
You have to have the right crop of players, the right group of players that are all pulling together. You don't want any individual in there that's all about themselves, because you don't win a game by yourself. You win a game as a squad, as 30 odd players or 23 players in tournaments. So a lot of work I know was done in the build up to the 2015 camp, with togetherness and, you know, dealing with if you're not playing and hiding your emotions if you're upset, or, you know, and really not bitching about it or showing that you're angry in front of other players, because the manager picks the squad. You don't take it out on your teammates, and that's what makes you a good team player. You give everything in the training, and then it's the manager and the assistant manager that talk about it and pick the squad. So then you just, if you're unhappy about it, you don't really show it. You show support, and then you make sure you're ready if needed to go on and help your team.
Did it really work though? Because even at that World Cup, where Mark Sampson, to his credit, did do a lot with team bonding, girls exchange shirts, didn't they, before the game? One player would give the other player their shirt in this kind of ceremonious way. But yet there were still players falling out with each other and swapping rooms. Are we always going to get this?
You're always going to get that.
Is it a female thing?
I don't know, because I've not really been involved in the men's game in order to comment on that.
And I don't want to compare it, but I'm thinking like an external person looking at the women's game.
Well, I had room with Faye White for a good 15 years. We never fell out. So it's just the way the game was back then. But yeah, I think you know you're not really going to like everyone in your workplace and your workforce. It's how you deal with your emotions, and you have to work together, because everyone wants to come together and win something. So I don't think everyone's always going to be happy in camp. But it is very intense when you're away at a World Cup or European Championships, because you're within each other's space 24/7 for a good few weeks. And I think Mark got it right in terms of he would give the players a few days off just to get away, wear your civilian clothes, get out, experience the city. Whereas when I was playing, we hardly had any days off with Hope. It was just really intense all the time, meeting after meeting after meeting, and you really got sick of it at times being in the tournament. And that's probably why we didn't perform as much, because we didn't have as much downtime and time away from it in a tournament. So I can see, you know, I see the players now. When I was out in 2015, they were out sightseeing and going on the seaplanes.
Into them in Moncton all the time.
Moncton, which was like the Ipswich of Canada, by the way.
I heard it was the people were a bit odd looking there.
It didn't help that the England, there's basically one hotel in the whole of Moncton that was big enough to hold a team and its staff, and it was split into two with the French team and the English team, who of course played each other. Quite a feisty game. So that didn't help that the girls were basically cooped up in a hotel with one of their main opposing sides. What's your take on Mark Sampson now?
Obviously, you know, he's not involved in the game. I don't know where he is. He's gone underground. I don't know if he'll ever get a job in football again. Who knows? But, you know, I do feel for him, because, it wasn't a nice way to go out. It's just a difficult one to comment on, really.
We can't speak to you without speaking about goals. And there's the famous picture of you kissing the boot. And I wondered if that was your favourite goal you've ever scored and whether that's represented by the way that you celebrated it, or if there is another that springs to mind more.
Well, that was the most iconic one that I've kind of been remembered for. And that is probably one of my most favourite pictures, mainly because, you know, I'd come back from a serious injury and had played on the national team for 10 years and not really qualified for any tournament. So it was my first tournament, England's first tournament in 10 years. And I did a lot of visualisation the night before the game and thought if I scored a goal, I'd just take my boot off and kiss it because that had never been done before. You know, you're taking your shirt off, whatever, I'm not going to do that. It was just like, and it happened within a moment, and then, you know, it just took it off, and then I just decided to run with it. So the whole celebration evolved. It just took me away with the elation of the goal, and then the second, I didn't even think I would score a second goal. I scored the second one, and then both boots come off, and I kissed it. So it was, that one wasn't planned.
What would you have done if you just scored three?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's got told off after for doing that celebration by the manager, Hope Powell, because she said I was a bit arrogant. And that players always, opposition always would want to kick me. So now you've just added extra spice to them, which I can get now. I got that after, so I didn't do it ever again. But I wouldn't have changed that because that's how I felt at the time. Just pure elation, first World Cup, four goals, helped England get to a quarterfinals, but it just wasn't meant to be.
Talking of Hope Powell, she called you a once or twice in a lifetime player, a former US coach. When you were playing over there, and that was when the team was achieving huge success, both on the Olympic and World Cup stage, said you would have been an automatic choice for the US national team had you been eligible, which is a huge compliment. And during 2011, Mia Hamm said during the World Cup that your touch is a different class, everything clean and with a purpose. And just to add to that, after you retired, Peter Beardsley phoned you up. Or he left you a voicemail, right?
Yeah, he said, just want to congratulate you on a fantastic career. You're the best number 10 that I've ever seen, and you were better than me. So that was a real nice comment from him, because I'd never met him before. And obviously he was a fantastic player for England and Newcastle. And obviously April Heinrichs was the US coach, I think, that said that. That's really touches my heart, because at the time, US national team were the best in the world, and the players that they had in that team were phenomenal. You know, Brandi Chastain, Mia Hamm, Christine Lilly, Brianna Scurry, just stacked with superstars all across it. So I actually idolised those players. I looked up to them and thought, I wish England were as good as this side, because if England were, we'd would have won a tournament, or if I could have played in that side, how good must I have been and that team would have been. So and then Hope Powell's comment was really nice, because she's been at the top of the women's game for a good 20 odd years for the national team, and she really helped develop me as a person and as a player, so that was nice.
So on the back of all this, do you still one day want to become England women manager?
That's a tough one, because I haven't coached and been out on the field for nearly a year now because of Rocco. And I think my main focus right now is just to look after him and raise him the best I can. I'm on the A licence. I haven't been out coaching because of childcare and that. So my goal, my focus isn't the England job right now. Who's to say in a few years it might happen? I don't know. But I really have to get out on the coaching aspect and learn and you know, make mistakes and grow as a coach. But right now, my focus is Rocco.
In terms of England women winning a World Cup, Claire Balding, I think, said that she thought that England women would win a World Cup before the men do. Do you agree with her?
I did, up until, obviously, the new crop of young male players that are coming into the game now. But I do think, it's close. It's a close call, because I think the crop of players now that Phil Neville has are very hungry for success and more talented than the players that I played with England. They've got a better game understanding. They're better technical players. The coaching aspect of the game now is a lot better, so they are understanding tactics more. And yeah, I think they've got a real good opportunity. But I'm also looking forward to this World Cup in Russia, because I think, you know, the crop of players that Gareth Southgate has to pick are young and hungry for it, and play, and haven't played, a lot of them haven't played in a tournament, so they've got no fear. And I think that is crucial going into a tournament, because I think the former crop of players, the men's players, they had a lot of fear and they were expected to win something, whereas these England players, no one's expecting them to do anything. They're not, a lot of people aren't even expecting England to get out of the group, so they've got nothing, you know, to prove out there, and that sometimes helps you perform better in tournaments.
What would the women winning the World Cup do for the game? What do you think it would do next? You know, we've got to a certain level, but I've always believed that winning ultimate silverware will change it for another decade, another however long.
Will it bring more profile to the game? I don't really know what would happen. I know with the women's rugby, them winning the gold has really elevated their game. Yes, a lot of people don't go and watch women's rugby, but just in terms of commercial, things have happened on that side. The women's cricket has become, when they won the World Cup, has become more at the forefront, more in the papers. So I think, you know, if England can go on and win that World Cup, that it would just change the whole face of the game. I think the players become more household names, more money will come their way, I guess, and the profile of the game will just get higher. I hope then more people will come out and support the club at club level, because I don't think, you know, a lot of people come out and support the women's FAWSL as much as we all hope. And I think that will really kickstart the league if they do win the World Cup.
Brilliant. Well, thank you for speaking to us, and we look forward to seeing what you do next. But in the meantime, enjoy being a mum. Mm. I really want to be there one day when you play him your best goals.
Yeah, he's actually, when he was first born, it was a really nice gesture. The FA actually sent my number 10 shirt. Obviously his size
shrunk it
with a little baby kit with the number 10, and it said Rocco on the back. So he's actually just fit into that now. So just ready in time for the Men's World Cup.
There we go.
Perfect.
Thank you.
The Offside Rule Exclusives is produced by Offside Productions and edited by Lucy Lavery.